The loss of a family member to war leaves a void that can never be filled, and the pain is magnified if the loved one is missing in action or recorded as a prisoner of war. The responsibility for providing information and offering closure to thousands of bereaved families falls to the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency and to its new director, retired Air Force Major General and 1977 Damien High School graduate, Kelly McKeag. We spoke earlier this morning about his mission and the surprising number of Second World War personnel still accounted for.
It's an anomaly to us as well. World War II was actually added to DPA's mission set back in 2009, mm-hmm. along with Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, to this day, there are sites, crash sites being found all over Europe, throughout the Oceania, Pacific region. It really is amazing. And if you see the numbers over history, obviously a majority of the ones that are missing are from World War II, but it appreciably drops to Korea. It drops even further with Vietnam, to the order of about 1,700 still missing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the 16 years of war in Afghanistan, there's not a single MIA from that conflict.
Because of what?
Because of personnel recovery. And the fact that the department as a whole pays more attention to it, has better resources in which to respond to it. And again, you used the term, I think, aptly, which is that fog of war.
You have so many people's hopes riding on you, don't you?
Yes, sir. And even second and third generation family members from World War II who are as much... That void is as much in their hearts as it was for their grandmother, great-grandmother, or what have you.
Yeah. It's a void that is never filled until you can get some kind of resolution. And what kind of tools do you have to provide resolution, especially with something as far gone as the Second World War?
So a lot of this is, it starts with research and our analysts and historians being able to cull through archives, being able to call through interviews, being able to piece together a picture that at least provides some fidelity as to where a loss might have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that fidelity is there, then we will send recovery teams out, often led by an anthropologist or archaeologist, to look for those remains. And then those remains, if found, come back to the largest forensic skeletal lab in the world, at which point working together with the Armed Forces DNA Laboratory, we'll use various techniques, tools, and technology to make that identification. And at that point, the Service Casualty Office will then have an encounter with the family from which they'll be able to then receive that closure.
So you have all the contact information you need on the family end, and you have pretty good record of who is unaccounted for.
Yes and no. So our numbers that are unaccounted for today are on the order of 83,000. However, of that,
wow,
if you take off the deep water at sea losses that we'll never be able to find with the technology we have today, the number gets down to about 34,000. Now, of that, because, again, as I mentioned, World War II and Korea are fairly new to Department of Defense's mission,
mm-hmm.
what happens is we're in the process of assembling family reference samples, DNA. You'll find that we have a pretty good record of DNA samples from family members from the Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
a higher number for Korea. We're still working on World War II, so part of it is an education process. Part of it is our services contacting families based upon genealogy,
mm-hmm.
and being able to secure those DNA reference samples.
And yet, it's a terribly important mission, and I know that you have contact with these families, and you get an idea of what it is for a family to have a missing member, don't you?
Absolutely. All it takes is to meet one, and you understand very early and very aptly how much of a void is in their life and how much it means to them that, A, the Department of Defense, the United States in general, commits the resources, time, and energy toward this. Because, it, again, sends a signal not only to the family members that their loved ones are not forgotten, but more importantly, and just as importantly, it also sends a message to those currently in uniform that the United States will not leave a fallen member behind and will do everything in our power to ensure that doesn't happen. But having said that, from the standpoint of what we are able to bring, those answers, that closure, I always tell people this is a humanitarian mission that defines us as Americans, that the United States is still doing this to this day, 70 years after World War II.
I'm looking at a map on your website that really is a, I think, would be a shocker for a great many people, the sheer numbers. And this has a little icon over Europe saying 20,947 missing World War II, another icon over North America, World War II, 1168, but different regions of the world listing the missing from conflicts in those regions. It's a powerful, powerful image, isn't it?
It is. It very much is. And you see the scope, the magnitude of how things were back then. And this is not to be pejorative against our predecessors, but, you know, there were millions of people in the war in both theaters, Pacific and Europe, and the losses are just staggering as to the carnage that occurred. And even for Korea, you can see the losses on that map across the Korean Peninsula.
And that's a war that is, for some reason, not fully understood, not much discussed these days.
Yes, sir. You're absolutely right. And well, as you well know, you know, it's still in an armistice status, as opposed to there has been no cessation of animosity and conflict between the both Koreas.
So that war technically has not been concluded?
That's correct.
Have all the families that need to find out about a missing family member, has everyone gotten in touch with you? Are there families that don't know about the resource that need to be getting in touch with you?
That's correct. There are a number of families, particularly World War II families, that are not even aware that the United States might be looking for their loved one. We have contact 7 times a year with regional meetings that we host throughout the United States. We've had one in Hawaii in the past where we invite family members that we know of in the geographical area to come to these updates to receive an update on their case, to provide a family reference sample, DNA, if they haven't done so. And then we hold 2 annual meetings here in Washington for Korea War family, Cold War families, as well as Southeast Asia families. But, you know, we continue to get the word out. We continue to work with our the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps to, again, developing those genealogies to be able to contact people that have yet to be contacted.
So there really are quite a few people out there. All the more reason to let people know about the work that you're...
Yes, sir, particularly from World War II.
A lot of people are going to be focusing on just the most recent Vietnam conflict, and I'm wondering how our interaction is with the current government of Vietnam in terms of tracing MIAs, POWs.
You know, that's a great question. The cooperation that we enjoy with the Vietnamese government actually predated the establishment of formal relations with the United States and Vietnam by about 3 years. Since then, and this was again back in the 70s, since then, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos have been tremendous partners in helping us determine the fate of missing Americans. There is an organic capacity that's being built in Vietnam. It speaks volumes to their commitment to the humanitarian nature of this mission. And if you think back to not that long ago, we were enemies, sworn enemies. To this day, we have teams, both investigative and recovery teams, that are jointly conducted by U.S. and Vietnamese personnel, similarly with Laotian and Cambodian personnel. And it just speaks volumes about the level of cooperation, the acknowledgement of the humanitarian aspects of this mission, and more importantly, how they feel committed to the United States fulfilling its moral obligation.
You're a lifelong military man yourself. Is this a function of a kind of a universal military code of honor, perhaps, that it transcends the differences of war?
It is for the United States. Besides us and the South Koreans, we're the only ones that actively, proactively pursue our missing. Other countries do it on a reactive basis, and they are of the opinion culturally that the service member, where he lies, is where his fallen grave site is, sacred ground. For us, we look at it as, again, a moral imperative to search for, recover, and identify the remains of missing service members. And so for us, it does transcend generations within the military. As I mentioned earlier, it provides an opportunity for the United States to recommit to currently serving members of the armed forces that this is an important imperative for the United States. And so, yeah, I think that's an absolutely great question from the standpoint of transcending generations.
Kelly McKegg is a retired Air Force Major General who began service as the director of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency on September 5th of this year. He's responsible for policy, control, and oversight of all aspects of the department's program to account for the nation's missing personnel from past conflicts. He leads DOD's worldwide enterprise and research, investigation, recovery, and identification operations and its supporting functions to provide the fullest possible accounting of missing personnel to their families. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the challenge of finding and keeping great teachers. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about the only shell in the world so beautiful and rare it is regarded as a gem. These hot pink, deep burgundy, sandy brown, and sometimes even olive-colored shells are home to tiny sea snails before they can be strung together in elaborate lays. The shells are known to come from one particular island because they are named after its first chief, but they're also found on a few others. Historically, these lei were reserved for only the highest-ranking members of Hawaiian society, and both Queen Emma and Queen Kapi'olani supported the delicate craft of stringing the lei pupu'uni'ihau by wearing the lei to meet foreign dignitaries and in royal photographs. The shells fascinated early explorers to the islands, with one writing of the extreme beauty and variety of necklaces of shells 6 yards long. Today, a simple single-strand lei with these shells can sell for a few $100s, but prices can easily soar to the thousands for more intricate designs. This morning, we're looking for its name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Misa from the Oahu Fringe Festival. If you like today's music, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org for a playlist.
How can the state of Hawaii recruit and retain the best teachers? We've been living with teacher shortages for decades, and the effort to find new approaches to the problem has led to an incentive program called Grow Your Own. The program offers scholarship stipends to Hawaii Department of Education employees who are emergency hires, substitute teachers, or educational assistants. It's a collaboration between the DOE and the University of Hawaii at Manoa College of Education. University of Hawaii College of Education Dean Don Young spoke with us about the effort to break a logjam that has existed for too long.
It certainly has existed for a long time. I can give you a personal story. I was recruited to come here as a teacher in 1969. Mm-hmm. My wife and I thought this would be a wonderful opportunity to go for a 1 or 2 year adventure. But, of course, that was some 47 years ago.
Yeah.
We never left. So
yeah.
We're probably one of the exceptions. But it's been a long, continuing, persistent problem that we've not been able to solve.
Mm-hmm. What's different about the current efforts to solve it?
I think the current efforts are being exacerbated by the fact that all of the teacher preparation programs in the state, and now there are about 9 or 10 of them, in addition to the University of Hawaii, which has 4 campuses. But it's being exacerbated by the fact that actually in my own college, College of Education at Manoa, the number of graduates with being recommended for teaching degrees has decreased. And in part, that's trying to get applicants. Once we get the applicants, we can get them through.
Mm-hmm.
But the particular other side of the issue is the retention issue, with the Department of Education still hovering around 50% retention after 3 to 5 years.
That's a pretty troubling statistic right there, because you think of teaching, as you yourself have seen in your own career, as a career that more than most carries with it a sense of mission.
Yes, and it attracts particular kinds of people because
yeah.
of that. I
mm-hmm.
mean, when I look at my own personal career and the impact that I've had the opportunity to have on students and teachers, that's what most people go into education for.
Yeah.
It's certainly not for although salary is certainly important, it's not the only reason people go into a field such as this.
Well, frequently people who teach have enough training so that they could probably make more money somewhere else.
that's probably true, and that, frankly, that may contribute to why some of the candidates, after they are in employment and teaching, do leave the field.
I would think so. That 3 to 5 year thing it makes one think that, you know, have they just grown disillusioned, or you know what? It'd be interesting to poll those people and see what their reasons are. Do you have some sense of what they are?
Well, we have some sense. I mean, the research is very clear. If we can get teachers to successfully complete that 3 to 5 year teaching experience, they tend to stay in the profession.
Mm-hmm.
So a number of things have happened. The Department of Education in recent years has done a phenomenal job of providing induction and mentoring, assigning a mentor to every new hire.
Mm-hmm.
And for our part in the College of Education, we've created a program called SONG, Supporting Our New Graduates,
mm-hmm.
In which we have 3 faculty members who work with our recent graduates for 2 to 3 years into employment, because we want them to be successful, and
sure.
we also want to be sure that they stay through that critical period. So there are some things happening in that realm that we're hoping will show promise, but the data are still not available.
Well, it makes a lot of sense to approach it that way, because the leaving after 3 to 5 years implies that you ran into problems you didn't anticipate.
Well, there are some disturbing new findings that we've recently heard from the department. The number one reason for those who are leaving the profession has changed recently. The biggest area is probably still retirements. But mm-hmm. if you look at why people are leaving the profession, they're leaving Hawaii. And we don't know, haven't been able to dig down into the data to find out who's leaving Hawaii. Is it recent recruits that mm-hmm. are leaving, which we've known has been a problem for a number of years? Or worse yet, do we know if it's some of our own students our local students who are leaving Hawaii?
Well, just, you know, most people hearing that would immediately say cost of living.
You can't deny it.
Right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Just, you know, without knowing any of the data involved, your immediate reflexive response is, hey, well, it costs too much, and you can do better somewhere else. And that's, you know, that's certainly the perception that you're, you know, working against with these new programs.
We are, and there's a larger context, too, that I want to mention, and that is, we need to change the narrative in the public, in the community, in the legislature, mm-hmm. to your listeners about teaching as a profession. There's been so much negative impact on teaching as a profession in recent years, that I think a lot of it has to do with just changing the narrative mm-hmm. of what teaching is all about and who are the people who go into teaching and make it their career. That's resulted in what we've been talking about the last 2 weeks of a campaign, a multimedia campaign called Be a Hero, Be a Teacher.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
It began actually with meetings with legislators back in November as we, meaning the University of Hawaii and other providers, were trying to brainstorm how we can address this particular persistent problem of teacher shortage. Mm-hmm. And among the items that were raised at the time were the cost of an education, cost of tuition. But the larger issue is just the feeling, reputation, rap, if you will, of teaching as a profession.
Yeah.
So in December, President Lasner called together all of the UH campuses, and as we mapped out what are the pathways to teaching that we have within the University of Hawaii system, mm-hmm. and there are many, what is it that we can do to change that narrative? So President Lasner was able to secure some funding to hire a multimedia vendor, Kai Media, who created both print, meaning posters, banners, announcements, flyers, and a multimedia campaign that includes PSAs, videos, and we've labeled the particular effort as Be a Hero, Be a Teacher. Mm-hmm. So that it was just really just launched about 2 weeks ago, and it's been getting tremendous support from the news media, including HPR. Mm-hmm. And the local newspapers. I understand that we've had over 9,000 views of the videos online, which we think collectively in the community can begin to change that narrative.
In conjunction with a kind of hearts and minds approach that you just described, what kind of economic support can government offer?
Well, thank you for asking. Again, starting with that meeting with the legislators, in particular Senator Michelle Kadani, the legislature last session for the first time funded in a small amount, but it's what amounts to state scholarships for mm-hmm. those going into teaching. So about $400,000 was allocated for scholarships. But they were they're targeting interesting populations that, as educators, we've never targeted before. Mm-hmm. Three in particular. Those scholarships are available to educational assistants who are already working in the schools, to emergency hire teachers who are already working in the schools, mm-hmm. and to substitute teachers. All three of those target groups we've never thought of as target groups before. They are, all three of them, we're targeting people who have an undergraduate degree, but the scholarships will provide funding for them to complete a post-baccalaureate certificate in secondary education over three semesters that will qualify them for licensure. The deadline for that, I might point out for listeners, the deadline for applications is October 1st, so we'll know by next week whether or to what extent that particular effort will be successful.
But I think that's an extremely pragmatic approach. Now we're getting to you're talking about a population of people who've already indicated a desire to teach and are actually, executing.
Yes. The other part of that is we're targeting what the Department of Education has identified as hard-to-filled subject areas as well. Mm-hmm. So the natural ones that people are most familiar with, mathematics, science, English, interestingly enough, world languages, and Hawaiian. So we're looking particularly for candidates who meet those particular fields as well as the most critical subject fields that are in shortage.
Be great if somebody listening were to become one of those candidates.
That's why I'm trying to give it a plug.
Thanks very much.
You have 1 week to apply.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
All right. Bye-bye.
Donald Young was appointed Dean of the College of Education at UH Manoa in August 2012. The Grow Your Own program will award up to $600,000 in scholarship stipends to recruit new teacher candidates who already serve in educational capacities in Hawaii. You can learn more about it on our Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what is the stupidest thing you could do with your money?
It's a tax on smart people who don't realize their propensity for doing stupid things.
It's Wall Street's nightmare.
How to be less stupid with money. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
A newly created homeless encampment on Hawaii Island has quickly become a target for both praise and criticism. It's Mayor Harry Kim's administration's latest effort to address the problems of the 1,000 or so homeless on Hawaii Island, some 70% of whom do not live in shelters or other transitional housing. Civil Beat reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Natanya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. This is an issue to whose solutions the solutions never can please everyone, can they?
This is true, and what Mayor Kim is attempting is definitely getting pushback from people within Hawaii, but also it's a method. Creating safe zones is a method that is generally opposed by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Why is that?
Well, the focus now is on housing first, which is a method that prioritizes getting people who are living on the streets into a housing unit rather than spending money on shelters or, in this case, it wouldn't really be a shelter, but an area that provides some amenities and some kind of shelter in some ways.
It's a venue that a facility with room for tents.
Right, exactly.
To put up tents. Mm-hmm. And a few amenities so that it's slightly more than the average homeless village. But these things are usually described as transitional, but the transition frequently doesn't take place, does it?
So there's a lot of different legal homeless encampments around the country, and criticism comes from folks who say that rather than acting as a place where people go to in some ways get back on their feet and then move into permanent housing, it ends up just being sort of a shanty town where people will stay for months or even years.
Mm-hmm. A dead end, in effect.
Yes, exactly.
So how do you break that logjam? You know, how do you address that issue?
Well, there are a few things that are essential. People who have studied safe zones across the country say location is very important. If it's close to an urban area, people who might be homeless but working need to be able to access their job. And social services are often located in, urban centers and urban areas. The current proposal for Village 9, Mayor Kim's, envisioned legal homeless encampment, is about 3 miles down a highway from Kona.
Mm-hmm.
But the prototype for Village 9, Camp Kikaha, is actually in an industrial area where a homeless resource center is located. Another thing that people really, feel is important is having access to social services. So if the location is far away from where a social service might be located, having whether it's case workers or mental health professionals actually go to the encampment.
This is the encampment we're talking about is not on a particularly appealing stretch of land, is it? It's not, we're not talking about a beautiful beach. We're talking about a piece of concrete in an industrial area, yeah?
Yes. Camp Kikaha, which currently provides, a shelter area for about 30 people, is an industrial area. And in some ways it's favorable because it shares a property with a homeless resource center. However, the
Tanya, I think we just lost your audio. Go ahead.
However, the proposed Village 9 is a little bit farther out, and there's currently nothing on the property. It's vacant state land with some bushes and lava rock. So it'll have to be transformed if this plan moves forward.
Well, we'll look to you to let us know when and if that transformation occurs, Natanya. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim. We spoke about the problems of teacher retention a few moments ago, and it makes you wish more teachers could find joy in their jobs. We thought about why Maya High School teacher, the founder of a hands-on student agriculture and aquaculture program, about the ways he has kept his job alive over a long career. His name is Greg Harding, and he clearly loves his work.
We started the program about 4 years ago. 2 years were just kind of cleanup and getting irrigation in, and we had a lot of the seed companies. They'd help us out, you know, like doing the major kind of cleaning with their backhoe and stuff like that. And then we just have a farm. It's like 3 acres. We have aquaponics. And what we do with the produce is we sell it to the teachers. And so we put out a weekly email saying what's available and the prices, you know, and what we have. And we've got chicken eggs. We've got about 40 chickens, 100 banana trees. And
wow.
It's a full ecosystem now where it used to be just a field of weeds.
How many students involved in it over the years?
About 120. Every year I get about 120 kids.
Wow. You know, it amazes, when you hear about something, it makes so much sense. When you hear about something like this, you wonder why everybody doesn't do it.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, you can grow your own food. It's like giving yourself your own paycheck, you know, because you don't have to go out and buy it.
Yeah. It's good food, too. Are you able to offer good prices to the teachers?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The best bananas you ever did have are $1 a pound, you know, so, you know, I undercut the stores, and it's just fresh. It's fresh produce, and the teachers just love it.
Did you run into, obstacles getting this off the ground? I mean, bureaucratic obstacles, technical obstacles?
No, none at all. My principal's real supportive, and, the teachers, they just love getting the fresh produce, and I have a student that's in charge of, you know, it's student run.
You know,
students, they get the orders, they get them ready, and then the teachers, they pay at the end of the month, so we just give them a bill, and so there's a little bit of marketing going on with the kids, and they seem to really enjoy it.
Sounds as if there are a lot of practical, not just in ag or aquaculture.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just a lot of practical skills even surrounding those activities.
Right, right, and teaching them sustainability through it all, because we use the chicken manure to put into our grow beds, and they just teaches them how to grow food. You know, and if they don't want to be a farmer someday, that's fine, but at least they'll know how to grow food.
I think I can hear one of your chickens in the background. It's a nice sort of counterpoint.
Yeah, you're gonna hear about a bunch of students come walking in my room here pretty soon.
Well, what's their attitude toward all this? Have they been pretty responsive since the beginning?
Oh yeah, and you know, you get the kids who work real hard, and then of course, you know, you're gonna have some that don't really want to do much, but there's a lot of jobs they can do. You know, if they're in charge of feeding the chickens, they're in charge of feeding the fish, you know, and maintaining, you know. Kind of like they're Kuleana, you know, like they've got their jobs and they know what to do.
Mm-hmm. I would think that having a sense of ownership of what they're doing would be a big part of it. That, in a way, for you as a teacher, you're sort of a guide once they get some of their own energy involved in this.
Right, right, and it's really fun to see, Chris, because you know you see kids. I don't even have to ask them to do anything. They see something going on, like a broken pipe or whatever, and they're on it and they're going to go fix it, you know.
Well, that flies against a lot of perceptions that people have of, you know, these kids today, right? It's pretty encouraging for you, I would think, just to.
Well, it is, you know, and I have a real good rapport with the students, and even my own kids went here, and so I've been here for 25 years, and I've taught a lot of their parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, yeah, that's a helpful continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Greg, if you were to, you know, if somebody were to call us and say, you know, what would it take to get it, this going at my kid's school or at my school, you know?
Well, they would just need, like, some land. You got to have land, and you have to have, you know, and every school has a lawn. You know, like the other day, our next-door neighbor's school, it's a junior high.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I took my tractor over there and I tilled up a piece of land for the teacher who wanted to do that. And so basically it's finding someone with machinery just to get you started. And then once that's tilled up and you got irrigation, you're ready to go, ready to grow.
Did you have a lot of specialized knowledge of farming going in?
No, not really, none at all. I haven't ever taken a class or anything, but I always had a garden, always had a home garden, and so I just brought my knowledge of that to here. And plus, we do a lot of searches on YouTube on, like, on the best way to grow tomatoes or the best way to grow cucumbers or whatever. And so, you know, I always have, like, a little lesson on growing before we before the class starts.
Do you meet for things like that? Do you meet in a classroom setting before you
mm-hmm.
go out in the garden?
Yes.
So the students are attuned to the whole idea that there's some education needed to be able to be effective out there.
Right.
When you're doing your tilling.
Yeah, and I have they keep a journal of what they're growing and how much they grew, because with my classes they're called crop production, and so you're graded on the amount of crops you produce.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like life, right?
Yeah. Well, good. You know, and I do tours. Kids will come up here, groups of people, senior citizens, you know, they'll come up and they'll get a tour of the garden, and we have second graders come up and they do a big field trip here, and kindergartners, and so it's the word's out there, and the teachers and the community are really in supportive.
Greg Harding is the founder of Waimea High School's Agriculture and Aquaculture program. Kauai Perspectives on Community Health is offering a hands-on visit to the farm on Thursday, October 26th from 9 a.m. to noon. You can find out more about it on our Facebook page, The Conversation. After explorers landed on Ni'ihau, stories of intricate lay crafted from rare shells traveled around the world, telling of the deep reds, browns, pinks, and even greens that adorned Hawaiian royalty. Measuring no more than 5 millimeters long with a turban-like tip, these shells are known to be the only ones in the world considered as gems and are said to attain their unique colors due to the unpolluted waters around their home beaches. Jewelers grade the shells based on quality, and local craftsmen still use the same techniques their ancestors used to string the shells into jewelry. These craftsmen sometimes spend hours lying on their bellies, scouring the beaches of Ni'ihau, Kauai, Molokai, and Lanai to hand-pick each shell because they're delicate and easy to break. The Ni'ihau Kahelelani is this sought-after shell, named after the first chief of the island. And we have a winner, Alice Tucker from Honolulu, is the one who knew that, got that right. She's the winner of today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Death both baffles and frightens us, and the rituals, ceremonies, and obligations that surround it only seem to add to the confusion. Caitlin Doughty, a 2002 graduate of St. Andrew's Priory who became a licensed mortician, traveled the world to compare the American way of death to customs, rituals, and ceremonies around the world. The result is her new book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. We began our discussion by looking at the way American society expects us to care for a loved one.
The funeral industry doesn't make it easy. either. They're not trying to make it simpler for the family to handle.
It often seems to me that the funeral industry creates a sense of obligation, you know, where you need to honor the loved one by buying an expensive box, that kind of thing.
They do, and that's how the entire industry is set up, both in the laws, in the regulations, in the funeral homes themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And unless there's real reform, there's no way to get out of that cycle.
Well, no bereaved family wants to go in and start haggling over price, right?
No. And you're made to feel tacky about it, and that it's just embarrassing and undignified to have questions about why this casket is $10,000.
Yeah. Well, how did this come into your life? How did you learn all that you've learned about the business? Kind of from the inside, right?
Yeah, absolutely from the inside. I got my first job. I was born and raised in Hawaii, and Hawaii is not, as you know, a place filled with death and darkness.
Right.
It's generally a pretty lovely, beautiful place to be.
That's what we like
but
about
I
it.
I was a pretty morbid child, though. I was interested in death, and I moved to the mainland for college. And after college, I got my first job at a crematory in Oakland, in California.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so interesting to see what was going on behind the scenes there and all the things that the funeral industry just doesn't tell you about what actual real death is like.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things should people know that they aren't told?
I think the number one thing is that people should know that they can be legally, they can be as involved as they want to be. If you want to sit with mom, you know, for a day and have her at the house and just have a funeral and have the whole family over to your house,
mm-hmm.
you can do that. If you want to be there for the cremation to witness mom being loaded into the machine or when she's buried, you want to be there, you are legally allowed to be there, and you shouldn't let a funeral director tell you what you can and can't do with your own family member.
The very title funeral director kind of describes a situation where an entire family, many of whose members are very independent otherwise, submit to the direction of a total stranger who pretty much tells them how it's going to be.
You're right. That's a really good point. I prefer the term mortician. It's an old-fashioned term,
yeah.
But I like it because, you know, beautician, practitioner of beauty, esthetician,
yeah.
practitioner of whatever. And so I think that mortician, practitioner of death makes more sense because funeral director, you know, just directing funerals, you're right. It's putting ideas into a family's head. It's presuming that the professional knows more than the family about what's best for the family, how they want to mourn.
Well, if you're selling a product and you want to be able to just set your own price and not get a lot of back chat about it, you want to make yourself into a director and pretty much take that posture of I'm the one who knows and you need to just kind of go along with this. And, you know, people who've just lost somebody, they're not in a mood to argue.
They're not in a mood to argue. And I don't want to sound like I'm just out and out bashing funeral directors here. A lot of funeral directors don't even know what the laws are. So if they're telling a family, oh, you need to embalm the body and chemically preserve the body before you can have a wake,
mm-hmm.
or you're not allowed to witness the cremation, or you're not allowed to keep mom at home for a couple of hours, they very well might not be trying to run this whole scam on you. It might be that they have entered a business and were told a certain thing,
yeah.
and they just don't know what the actual laws are.
That's true of probably in a lot of areas.
In a lot of areas, but the laws are very pro-consumer, and they're very about the family being able to make the right decision for them, and that's how it should be.
Sounds as if the best path is to find out what those laws are, yeah?
Exactly. And really, in Hawaii, they're pretty good. You're allowed to really not use a funeral director if you want to. Most people will want to. It's not a logistical task that they want to take on themselves.
Sure.
But just know that if you want to come in and do mom's hair, or if you want to help put her lipstick on or put her in her favorite sweater, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to do that.
Well, you know, Caitlin, especially in your new book, you've traveled the world to find out the many different ways, rituals, and customs that people that accompany death in other cultures, yeah?
Yeah. It was an amazing opportunity to get to travel everywhere from Indonesia to Bolivia to Mexico to Europe, to Japan. And I think Japan, for Hawaii listeners, Japan is one of the most interesting places because we have obviously have such a large Japanese population, but also the Japanese people have some of the most interesting technology and innovation around deaf in the entire world.
What kind of technology? That's a surprise to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've ever been to Tokyo, the fact that they're connected to technology wouldn't be that big of a surprise.
Yeah.
But what I loved about Japan is that they still respect the dead body, and they want to be around the dead body, and they want to honor the dead body. But then after the cremation takes place, and they have a 99% cremation rate, by the way, it's the highest in the world.
Uh-huh.
After the cremation takes place, I went to several places. One, which is a big, several-story place that they store ashes right off the subway, where you go in and there's a little altar with a grave in it and incense and flowers, and there's a little hole right in the middle of the grave. And you use a tap card, like a subway card, on a keypad, and it goes boop, 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 and it whirs, and a robot arm goes into the bowels of this place, plucks out your mom and brings her ashes into the grave and deposits it there so you can have your moment and do your prayers and then get back on the subway and go back to work.
That's completely amazing, Caitlin.
Isn't it? And there's all sorts of stuff like that in Japan. There's a corpse hotel where at any time of the day and night you can come visit. You know, they'll put dad out for you in your own individual room, and there's a place that you can stay overnight with the bodies if you want that. There's LED columbariums that are 360 degrees of glowing Buddhas that have ashes behind them. It's really amazing what they're doing there, and it makes you realize how the U.S. is so against that kind of innovation when it comes to death.
You know, I can imagine, Caitlin, that for you as a writer, putting this book together was full of moments like the subway moment in which you said, I've really got something here.
It was, and it's sometimes it's hard for me to tell because I'm such a deaf geek, such a deaf nerd. I'm so interested in this topic and always have been. So I'll be at the Corpse Hotel, for instance, and just be thinking, this is amazing. I want one of these. Or I'll be in rural Indonesia and see a family taking care of their mummified grandmother in their own home. And I'll think, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. And then you just hope, as a writer, that you can translate that enthusiasm and how interesting it really is and how different from the United States it really is when you actually write the book.
Caitlin Doughty is a 2002 graduate of St. Andrew's Priory and the author of From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. It'll be released October 3rd. Caitlin is now a licensed mortician, author, and blogger. She founded the Order of the Good Death, which is a community of funeral industry professionals, academics, and artists who advocate for a more death-informed society. Since 2011, she has produced a series for YouTube called Ask a Mortician.
Hi, I'm William Skilling from the William S. Richardson School of Law. You can hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
There are a lot of activities, different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama somehow managed to keep track of them. He joins us for a look at events going on in our community under the radar. Today, we can celebrate and support creative projects in Honolulu at a dinner tomorrow evening.
Yes, HNL Soup is called a micro-granting dinner. If you're familiar with that phrase, for $15, yeah, me neither.
Never heard.
For $15, you'll get soup, bread, and a vote. You'll hear about three projects ranging from urban agriculture to social entrepreneurship, and you vote on the project you think will benefit the city the most, and the project with the most votes gets all of the money raised that evening. And this is happening tomorrow starting at 6, at Impact Hub Honolulu in Kaka'ako. And for more information, go to our website.
That's
please.
Pretty intriguing.
Yeah.
And then you can also learn how to make poi tomorrow if you mm-hmm. happen to be on Hawaii Island.
Yes, at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Park rangers will share their knowledge of kalo or taro at this authentic cultural experience. The roots of the kalo plant will be cooked and pounded to create fresh poi. It's from 10 a.m. until noon on the Kilauea Visitor Center Lanai.
And by pounding the poi, you work up an appetite. Right?
Oh, definitely, yes.
And you can become a clean water ambassador in Kalihi tomorrow.
This free workshop is for anyone living in Kalihi. That would be me, who wants to keep the neighborhood and waters clean and healthy.
That would be you?
That would be me. The city will train you to get the tools you need to help the community stash trash and unclutter gutters. It's from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Bishop Museum tomorrow. Register at the link on our website.
Derek, I'll expect you to gain a great deal of expertise in how to do that.
I will tell you and come back what happened.
Thanks very much.
Tell you what happened.
Derek Balama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll look at a documentary film about the efforts of citizen journalists in Raqqa, Syria. We'll talk with Nandita Sharma, a member of Hawaii J20, the group bringing a free screening of the film City of Ghosts to Honolulu. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkook. Join us tomorrow.